Welcome to the ABCs of Disability Planning podcast. If you're new to the podcast, my name is Eric Jorgensen. I'm the founder and host of ABCs Disability Planning and the company True North Disability Planning. I started this podcast to help families and professionals learn about organizations who are doing amazing things for those with disabilities at a national level. Not every podcast is going to be an organization. Some of them are going to be people who are helping, who are maybe solopreneurs, but they're helping individuals of all types of disabilities, physical, emotional, intellectual, really live a better life. Today, Carolyn Long, the co-founder of Social Optics, is doing that in spades. She is equipping teens with a communication toolkit for social-emotional well-being. It's an app built on trauma response model, using evidence-based practices in technology-aided instruction intervention, direct instruction, social narratives, modeling, video modeling, social skills training, task analysis, visual supports, and scripting. Her company is really walking the talk. 50% of her staff is autistic. We had a great conversation. Towards the end there, I went on a little bit of a rant against some states that are doing things I don't agree with, specifically around physical restraints. Well, really, that's the bottom line, is physical restraints and corporal punishment. And I just really think using a tool like Social Optics to train and help students better communicate without requiring them to mask is a much better way to avoid behaviors and maybe shorten outbursts instead of trying to restrain somebody. That was the gist of the rant that I went on towards the end. But overall, this is a great tool. I really encourage you, if you have a student in high school, if you're a teacher, or even if you're homeschooling, check out the Social Optics website. There's going to be a link in the show notes. Reach out to Carolyn. She said they're a hard fit. They're not a hard sell. They really want to make sure that Social Optics is going to be right for your student more than they want to make the sale. So check them out. The information's in the show notes. And if you feel so moved after listening to this podcast, please share it with somebody and leave a review. Thanks for listening. Let's dive in. Welcome, everyone. Today, I'm going to be talking with Carolyn Long about Social Optics. Social Optics, their mission is a focus on helping teens live their best lives by helping them improve their perspective, problem solving, and communication. And I'm going to go into it with, I'm going to have Carolyn explain to me how they do that, what they do, what they are, and really how they are going to equip teens with the communication toolkit for social emotional well-being. Because as they say on their website, it's not just for teens. You know, you help these teens develop these skills and they can be carried over in adulthood. And I would imagine adults can do this too. So with that intro, Carolyn, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Eric. This is exciting stuff. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about Social Optics. I was reading your bio on your website and it says you did, I think it was 2 years you did this in person.
So actually we were doing the class in person since 2015. So So where it kind of got its start, I was working in a district. We had a high school with about 2,600 students in it. So it was a large high school. So we had a significant population of students, what I call high masking autism. So They were in, you know, all of the regular education classes, but still struggling with friendships and with working in groups and, you know, sometimes just understanding the reason and the rationale behind it, you know, why they were doing an assignment. And so another teacher and I were asked if we could help these students. And so we started this class in 2015. And that first semester, we were just using existing programs and they were all very skill-based. We didn't feel good about it as teachers, and our students sure as heck didn't feel very good about it. And so by the second semester, we just kind of threw everything out the window and just were working side by side with the students. What do you need? You know, because even it sounds so long ago now since COVID, you know, but even in 2015, the social scene changes so rapidly for students these days, so much faster than we were in high school, you know, between TikTok, Snapchat, just it seems like stuff cycles through sometimes every 3 months, some of the you know, the ways kids are interacting changes. And so teaching a discrete skill wasn't cutting it, because they would finally master that skill and it would be outdated or it wouldn't be functional. So
could you give an example of what a discrete skill is?
Sure. So something like some of the rehearsals for, you know, asking a friend out to go to a movie.
Okay.
So inherent in that skill are a whole bunch of steps. Like, first of all, just even identifying who would be a friend, the different relationship levels, is somebody you can ask, you know, and then what is sometimes considered the skill itself, the outward behavior that you see, which is how you ask. But like, even how you do those things, like, sometimes most kids are asking other kids to do things on Snapchat, you know,
right,
or via text or even Instagram. Like, honestly, what's been interesting to me, I have a 16-year-old daughter. They don't even text each other anymore. Like, to give somebody your phone number to text shows a high level of friendship. They do most of their interactions on Instagram and Snapchat. And so for my generation to be working with these students, like, we needed to have a better way for even the student and I to be able to converse and get the details of exactly what they need to be able to navigate that social scenario. Because for me to be considered an expert in teen social just isn't going to happen, you know?
Right.
Like, we have to discuss it.
Yeah. So you lose all credibility when you say, well, why don't you just call them?
Yes.
Right. I mean, that was what we did back in the day when we had the phones hanging on the wall and you had to, had to push the buttons or, oh my gosh, rotary.
right. It took 10 minutes just to call somebody, and God forbid if you messed up a number, like, you gave up. So that was kind of the push. So by that second semester, we were working with the kids, and by that second year we taught the course, we were really working on what is a set of tools that we can all use to discuss these situations, that then not even just the students but we as teachers could take, you know, and use ourselves. And that was really the beginning. So along the way, I was very data oriented. So I was using Pearson's social skills improvement system to collect pre and posts for students. Okay. So we were seeing, you know, improvement with student awareness, teacher rating scales over time started to improve on what they were observing as the behavior. And I think to me, that's also been one of the pieces that's been frustrating for me too, with so many of the options we've had out there to work with teens, has been they're very, what we see on the outside base, they're very, the actual outcome, the behavior base is how we're measuring success. And we're not always honoring the processes that the kids are going through to get to that observable behavior. And so that was something that we found as we started teaching this, we could start to actually have those discussions about metacognition and what is the process you went through to get to your outcome. And then start to have those conversations about, well, would you shift it? Would you not? Because again, it's always a choice. And we tend to, with a lot of good intent for wanting students to succeed, we take away their choices sometimes, especially related to social. And so this was really designed to give that back and give us all a way to communicate.
It really sounds like the difference, if you're a professional, the difference between working with a coach and a consultant, right? Like, a consultant is going to tell you, this is what you need to do to accomplish X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. A good coach is going to ask you questions to, you know, to help you. I mean, sometimes they might have to step in if you're just really, you know, stumped, but usually they're going to ask you questions and let you figure the answer out, right? And it sounds like that's what you're doing with these teams.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yeah. And giving a framework in which to do it, because, you know, your answer to your questions are only ever going to be as good as the question you can ask.
Right.
And so finding a way to everyone have that same vocabulary toolbox, everyone have the same framework that you're working from, you start to ask better questions, and the students start to feel more confident responding to your questions, because now they've got the confidence that even if I don't quite get it right, I've got more tools in my toolkit now. I can try this, I can try that. And so we saw, you know, self-esteem, self-confidence, kids trying more things, and all of that to start to improve. So
how long does this take? Is this like an ongoing thing from freshman to senior year or whenever they leave high school? Is this
I feel like it can honestly kind of be like a cradle to grave, you know, for all of us, you know, because things are always shifting. But for students, so the way we have the program designed right now is students log in and they work through some direct instruction lessons directly through the platform that's collecting quantitative data. So we get some initial Do they even understand the vocabulary of the concepts we're talking about? Do they understand the concept itself? And then we get some qualitative data. So there's built-in application questions. We can start to see how they're using the information and how they think about how they're using the information. So we actually start to get a little bit of a profile of how they see themselves as communicators, what they see as their strengths, what they see as things they want to work on. And then there's a component that are supplemental lessons. So having worked in the school districts for 15 years, I know it's often very hard. I was very lucky in my school to be able to have a dedicated class to this. We calculated that in the course of 1 year with kids in that class, we were able to deliver the equivalent of 5 years of an hour of therapy a week for each kid, assuming the kid never missed a therapy session for 5 years. We were able to accomplish all of that in 1 year with the instruction. So kids go through the direct instruction part online. Teachers or parents or homeschool groups can use the supplemental lessons to give more application of the content that's in the software. And then there's a teacher dashboard that lets you see, you know, where the student is at, what they maybe need a little bit more practice on. So you can pull the supplementals that match with the areas where maybe their test scores or their quiz scores were a little bit lower. And then there's even a professional development component built into that teacher dashboard. So teachers can go in there and watch some short 10, 15 minute videos that give more of the research behind how this was designed, the evidence-based practices that we use, how to use it. And then also, because I'm such a nerd about research, and I also think it's so important. I love our students and I loved working in the high school, but sometimes it also was a lot of pressure because I knew I only had these kids for 4 more years and then they would basically hit that cliff. And so every minute that I had with them, I knew I had to make it count. So we're already part of a research study with University of Montana to look at the efficacy of technology-aided instruction on improving social pragmatic skills in adolescents. So, and that is, I'm part of the team, but I'm not the principal investigator. And it's objective, you know, third party. It is not, we're not paying for this research. We're just, you know, going to engage in it to make sure that what we're doing, you know, and how we're doing it, we're moving quickly to iterate and help students. So
I want to cover a couple things real quick, Carolyn. Backing up a minute, you know, even though I agree with you, this could carry on cradle to grave, like you had said, it's really earmarked for people in high school, for students in high school, right? That teenage 13 to 18 or 21 age range, right?
Yeah. So the first course that we've released this year is for high school, but we'll be releasing a middle school course next year because we've already gotten some feedback that that's a need. And actually this course has been dropped down into some eighth grade level classes. So we'll be focused on middle school for next year and continuing to build out the high school courses.
Okay. And this is being recorded. We're in March, 2023 now. So we're talking about middle course being released in 2024.
Fall of 23, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yep. We'll get it out next fall. Mm-hmm.
Fall of 23. And then my next question would be, I guess it's more of a statement. I don't see why this would have to be given to students who are just in special education. I feel like this could be given to every student in the class as part of the least restrictive environment, and then let the student be around their peers, because it feels like, if I'm understanding correctly, every student's going to be logged into their own profile. So every student is going to be evaluated based on his or her own skills and assessment of themselves. So there's no reason to take this out when the student is taken out for speech or occupational therapy or something else. There's no reason to do it then, right? Am I on the right track, Carolyn? Is that kind of how you see it used?
You would almost think we'd planned this. Like, and I know we haven't, because I don't get the questions ahead. But like, seriously, that's exactly right. And actually, we've had a couple of school districts already moving it as a tier two intervention for students who are not even, you know, identified as special education yet.
So for those of us that aren't teachers or in the education system, what's a tier two intervention?
So in most school districts, we work off of something called the multi-tiered system of supports. Okay. And so tier one interventions are things that the whole class gets. That's, you know, just general instruction for the whole class. Tier two supports are geared towards K kids who are maybe not making the progress we want to see with just the general instruction, and what additional things can you do? There's always a little bit of gray area around what tier three supports are, but theoretically, tier three supports are supposed to be designed to be some maybe one-on-one or small group instruction in a potentially even a different curriculum for those students. And then beyond that, if a student is not making progress, then we look at a special education referral process and maybe an evaluation. So yes, it has, like, that's the cool thing about the lenses and the critical thinking piece, which is the basis of the toolkit. They're designed around a critical thinking framework that we all use when we communicate with each other. We just all use the different pieces to greater or lesser degrees, depending on our personal experiences, our emotional state, our cognitive ability that day. And so what it does is, when you're in the middle of an interaction with someone and you're not quite sure which way it's going to go, or you're not understanding where they're coming from, or maybe even you're starting to feel your stress level elevate or become upset, you can start to break down, okay, I'm going to go through this checklist first. Like, what are the details I'm seeing? What do I know about this person? Okay, not very much. So that doesn't help me out here. You know, where do I put in these other pieces? And then you can ask better questions. You can decide whether you need to step away. And that works for both sides, because communication is a two-way street, and it can be very confusing for both people in interactions, you know, for neurodivergent students, you know, and neurotypical students. And sometimes that's one thing I found in the high school. I think we see it quite often. When you're not sure you have a tool to handle something, you see students walk away from engaging with other students that they might otherwise have carried on a conversation with, you know. And that's what we noticed, you know, when we were giving kids these tools, they were able to engage in activities that they weren't previously, because they had a few more things they could try. But for me, the biggest thing was, and if they tried them all and they didn't work, they didn't feel bad anymore. They're just like, okay, well, that's it. Maybe I got to learn something new. Maybe next time with something else, you know, well, maybe there's some missing information. This was never going to work today. And to me, that was the, I don't want to say the hardest thing, maybe the most heartbreaking thing of working in the high school was, you're getting the kids at the end of a journey of a lot of interventions and therapies, and you're getting them at an age where they're starting to become very self-aware, and they don't always feel very good about themselves. And to me, that was the greatest outcome I wanted to give these kids, that, you know what, we don't all get it right. We don't all know. And I'm not the expert of your life. You are. So here's some tools, work it out. And at the end of the day, feel good that you tried, because so many people don't. And sometimes the people who aren't trying are your teachers and your peers.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, Carolyn, because I think back to my time in the military, and even my time since I've been a civilian, there's communication breakdowns even frequently, even between people that don't have disabilities. And I would almost want to stick up for those with disabilities and say they shouldn't have to do all the work, you know. Yes. So all this is great for those that are in, you know, in a public school, or I'd imagine private schools with the right budget. What about people that are homeschooling? Because I could see that being a concern, where they may not be getting enough interaction with peers as it is. I don't know anything about homeschooling. So if you're a homeschooler out there and you're like, oh, we get plenty of interaction, you know, forgive me, I'm pleading ignorance, but with this tool, I mean, is there a way for it to be adapted to a homeschool curriculum, or?
Yes. So right now we integrate with Clever, which is a rostering system that many school districts use. If a school district doesn't use it, we can help them get set up with it at no cost to the district. And so we can create a homeschool group the same way. So okay, we can basically count a homeschool group as a district and get them set up with Clever, and then, you know, get their students logged on, and all of the same professional development, everything, access to us for questions, applies to homeschool groups as it does to school districts.
Now, is there an additional fee to Clever? Again, I'm showing my ignorance here, but, you know, I know cost can be a barrier to a lot of school districts.
Yeah, not for Clever. The burden of cost for using Clever falls on the software developer. So that's us. So every time we add a school district, we pay Clever more money to be able to use it, which is fine. It works out. And it's a, you know, it's a great service. So no, you know, and then for, you know, we do have our license fee and we just are upfront with it on our website. But if there are, you know, groups larger than, you know, like five, we're always welcome, like happy to discuss costs with folks because we don't want somebody to not be able to use it because they can't afford it. There's always a way. So just reach out. We've got some avenues for some grants and funding, but then also too, if it's a larger group of students, we can definitely work with the cost on that too.
So the cost per license is per student?
Yes.
That makes sense, right? So, you know, so a school district could get a license with Social Optics for a freshman class of, let's say, 100 students or whatever, right? And then they could keep renewing that license for every new freshman class, you know, and hopefully they would scale up for the sophomore, junior, senior. But that would be one way where they, you know, they could work with you on pricing, because if they say, hey, we're going to be doing X number of students for X number of years, well, now as a business, speaking as a business owner, I'm not, you know, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but speaking as a business owner for myself, if I know I have X number of clients for a set number of years or whatever, well, that means I can make an easier budget around it. And I am more likely to give a discount.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely, you know, one of the ways that we want to try to help folks with it. There's another thought I just had and it totally flew out of my head, but it'll probably come back in a second. Yeah. So definitely willing to work with groups and willing to work with folks on, you know, on pricing. Oh, I remember now. There we go. So the other, you know, piece for our pricing structure is every course at the high school level is designed around the 65-hour-ish like Carnegie unit. So in a high school class for semester math, you get a half credit because it's designed around the idea that about 65 hours you've been in class or working on classwork related to that subject. So we actually have a couple districts, smaller districts, so it's a little bit easier with their school boards, but they've actually approved it for credit as an elective credit.
Oh, wow.
And also as a CTE, career and technical education credit, because it aligns with the standards related to soft skills and social communication at the workplace. So that's where our pricing came from, was just if you were going to do an online science class through BYU for half a credit or something like that for a high school student, it's about, you know, in that price range. So
that's really cool. So, and then again, there's more incentive there for students who don't necessarily have disabilities to take these classes as well. And, yeah. You know, and really arm themselves when they get out into the job or into the going to college.
I see it, you know, too, as an, you know, like being in the high school too, it's really, you know, students are in class. They don't want to be pulled once a week to go work with the speech therapist anymore. You're not as cool as you were when they were in second grade, you know, and also they're not getting credit for this extra time. Like not only are you taking them out of class, they're falling behind in a subject and they're not getting any extra credit for working with you. So what makes me happy about this scenario is maybe like kids can actually get credit for working on their IEP goals.
Wow. Yeah, that's really cool. So this would be just like any other class where you would be in, and it's been a long time since I left college or since I left high school. I graduated in 92. So it's, you know, I don't really remember what high school was like, but so a student would, you know, maybe take their math, an hour math, an hour science, and then they could come in, take an hour of social optics for a semester. And then the next semester they might take I don't even know if home ec's a thing, but you know, or like it, I took typing, right? Like this is how old I am. I took typing on a typewriter for that half credit.
Yeah. So, you know, it's even easier than that because so they don't even have to work on this an hour a day. So the lessons the kids do are about 10 to 15 minutes each online.
Okay.
And so by the time they work through all 10 modules and there are 12 lessons in each module, like they've accumulated that number of hours, you know, worth of work. And then it's assuming that an SLP or an occupational therapist or their resource teacher, or, you know, if it's a homeschool group, maybe the parent is doing one of the supplementals about an average of 3 a month.
Okay.
Plus those courses. And when they get all of that work done, you know, whether it takes them the whole school year to complete all of it, or they get it done in one semester, then they could, you know, earn the half a credit.
So
they could work on it in a study hall. They could work on it, you know, if they're always finishing math early, they could jump on then, you know,
homeroom or, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We have some school districts who they've added it into that homeroom time. So
That's very cool. That's very, very cool. Are you national? I mean, are you available anywhere in the country if somebody wanted, or are you limited geographically?
No, we're actually, so I'm based in Montana. My co-founder's in Tennessee, but we have schools in Montana, Wyoming, California, Kentucky, and some additional states that we're working with onboarding. So anywhere we can get somebody set up with it.
Right, because all they need is an internet connection or whatever to download. Mm-hmm. And then it says you're an app. Does that mean they access via an iPad or a smartphone or a tablet? Or is it on a computer in a classroom?
It's computer. It works, the interface with a computer, iPad, the best. The phone is still, it's just a little bit more difficult to move through the lessons because everything's smaller and stuff like that. There's audio that goes with, you know, everything for the students. And then we've got it set for two different lex styles. So, you know, if your student's on grade level in that 9th, 10th grade, but if they're not, we have, you know, a lex style level that's more along the 2nd, 3rd grade level too. So we can adjust for that as well.
Okay. And right now everything's just in English, right? It's all English based.
It is right now. Yeah.
Well, it's on the roadmap. This is a lot. Yeah. This is a lot to do.
Yeah, yeah it is.
Wow. This is crazy. So how would, if a parent was listening to this and they said, oh, I want to learn more. You work with school districts, right? So the parent would want to approach their school district. What would the next step be if parents are listening to this and are like, wow, I really want this for my kid?
So, yeah, great question. So they could, you know, a couple things. Yeah. So if their student is in public education and they're thinking this could be something that could be added to their, you know, their children's school day, they could, you know, just share our website and, you know, share my email with the student's teacher. You know, if they wanted a little bit more information to bring to the teacher, they could certainly email me at carolyn@mysocialoptics.com. And I can, you know, provide some additional materials that they could print off or, you know, send to the teacher. And then we just, you know, start the conversation that way. You know, teachers just reach out over email and we're happy to connect and set up a meeting. You know, Lisa's and my focus is on the student and the teachers and having this be the right fit, because at the end of the day, it's the students that this is for. So if it's not a right fit right now, you know, it's not a big deal. Like, we just want to help teachers and students however we can. So it's, you know, I know when I was working in districts, I always got a little bit squeamish when I would get on the websites of something I was interested in and it would say like, there'd be no pricing. And it would say, if you want to learn more, you're sucked into a 30-minute demo. And like, I have vowed that that's not the way we operate. If you want to learn more, reach out. We are not a hard sell. We are a hard fit. We want to make sure it fits and happy to talk, you know, with anybody about anything. So.
Now, are teachers the right people to talk to? Because then they have to go to the administrator, right? I mean, typically teachers don't have a budget, even though I know a lot of teachers seem to pay out of pocket for things.
Yeah. So that's a good, the folks that actually make those budget decisions are the superintendents and the special education directors. Sometimes the principals have, you know, a budget within the building for this. So it's kind of gone both ways. We've actually had special education directors that have received, you know, some of our information and then they've passed it down to teachers. We've had a number of teachers and specialists like SLPs pass it up, you know, and then we have a meeting, you know, with the team. It can go, you know, it goes both ways. And that's what I found, you know, even when I was working in the district, if I saw something cool, I would let my SPED director know about it. And then we would start the conversation, you know, and so, you know, however, whoever is interested, we're happy to talk. And then it just, we can help them navigate to how to ask their special education director, you know, to make sure they've got the right information to answer the questions that we know they're going to ask them about it.
Okay, very cool. Yeah, I mean, I've been to your website. It's pretty easy to navigate. It's you are very upfront about the pricing. You know, I think this is really cool. I wish I had some of these skills before I joined the Navy, because I just feel like there was a lot of things I learned the hard way, right? I mean, can you talk to me more about built on a trauma response model versus, you know, other models that may not be so ideal? What is a trauma? And again, speaking from ignorance, but what is a trauma response model?
So the trauma response model in school districts, it's the idea that we, not the idea, because we do try to, you know, set up safe spaces where kids feel safe, where they feel heard. And, you know, where when situations arise, the team tries to take into consideration that there could be outside factors that we don't know about influencing that kid's reaction to something. So the design of the whole course and program itself, just being based on a critical thinking view and lens, and then applying that across different situations, is trauma informed, because it's not, again, that kind of skill based, like you have to look like this, you have to do this. It's taking into consideration that you can start to think about what are the influences in your own life that are maybe causing you to react to something this way, or, you know, choose to do something else. And also, how do you apply that to understanding how other students are feeling? You know, I had a student, I did a podcast, another podcast with a student, Nick. And on that podcast, we were talking about, we, every Friday, we would have like a game day in that class, and we would play Uno, and it got pretty rowdy sometimes. We won't go into all that, but there was a young woman in the class who was in the class because she was very kind of quiet and shut down, and she had not the best home life. And so sometimes, like, she'd be having a great time, but then, you know, Nick was just, he's a loud, boisterous guy. He'd get a little bit too loud for her. It would go over her threshold. And it was an opportunity, you know, Nick did not want her to feel bad, and she didn't want Nick to feel bad for being too loud, but no matter what they were going to do, his volume was never going to match what her threshold could meet. And so somebody was going to have to shift. And so they were able to have that conversation. Like, Nick was able to read her body language, and instead of thinking, oh, I'm doing something wrong, and him getting up and leaving the room, he now had some tools to ask, and she had some ways to talk about it that were not, you're being, you know, too much for me, it's just, I need this. And, you know, they could kind of work it out. And that was, he was able to identify that and, you know, help her, stay comfortable. And then it became a choice for him to want to change his volume, not a, remember, we have three volumes. We have, you know, one is whisper, two is inside voice, three is outside voice. Like, it wasn't that anymore. It was just the real normal way we adjust ourselves when we're watching other people. And so that's kind of like part of the aspect of trauma. Also, sometimes people who have experienced trauma, like in schools, it can be very difficult. You can know a kiddo might be struggling, but it's our job to care about the kids and give them the space if they want to talk or share about it. But it's, you know, as a school teacher, as an SLP, I'm not a therapist, and that's not what the purpose of being in that school is at that time, if that makes sense. So where I'm always there for the kid if they need to open up, and then I can get them to the correct person in the school, maybe the counselor or the school psychologist. When we started using these lenses with students, they didn't feel, what's the word I'm looking for here? So they were able to step back and see situations a little bit more objectively as well. So they weren't always being so kind of emotionally triggered. And if they were, they were seeing that trigger a little bit easier. And then they had the vocabulary to maybe discuss what it was in the situation that triggered them. And so we found kids that were often more reluctant to engage were more willing to start to engage in our activities because of that. And then we saw the carryover in the other classes because they had the language structure and the vocabulary to start to express themselves clearly in other places as well. And so that was a benefit.
Well, that's awesome. I see a lot of use for this. Again, I don't think social optics needs to be limited to people with disabilities. You know, I grew up in a very abusive child, you know, home and stuff, physically and emotionally. So I still, and I'm loud, I wear hearing aids, right? So, and you know, there are times where I can get triggered, or I get very passionate and I'll see people shrink away. And, you know, I'm 6 foot, 200 pounds, getting loud. You know, and if I'm in a room full of women who are like 5'1", 5'2", not really the best, not the best vibe, right? But it took me trial and error to learn that, you know, a lot of trial and error to learn that. And well, you know, what you just described with Nick would have been very helpful back in the day.
Well, and now imagine how much more okay you would have felt if you knew all those women in the room also had that same information. And so they weren't looking at you as this scary figure, but as, huh, like, that's not what I was expecting in this situation. I wonder what else is going on with him. Like, let's give that grace instead of that whole there's right or wrong, you know, like it just it makes everybody feel so much better.
Yeah. Cause I remember like when my wife was alive, we would go to IEP meetings. It was Eric, don't talk. Right. Because I'm just very passionate, I take a lot of space, not intentionally, but I'm a big guy, you know, and it just, she'd be like, and my wife was 5'0" and, you know, she's like, I'll take it. I got it. I'll let you know when you can, when you can talk. But it, yeah, I mean, I can see a lot of use cases for this, you know, with so many different world environments, law enforcement, even therapists, helping them, you know, be more informed. You know, some of the older therapists who may not be as well versed with people with disabilities because of what you mentioned way back in the beginning of this podcast episode about masking and you know, how the therapist may not have any experience with somebody with a disability being their authentic self. And they don't know how to create a safe space to let that person be their authentic self. You know, and I know that's not where you're going with social optics, but I can see so many other use cases.
There are a lot of other use cases. And that was something too that I always was a little mystified by sometimes when I knew some of my students were working with outside counselors. But I knew some of my students, they had a hard time even putting together a simple narrative of what they did that weekend.
Yeah.
And so I imagine that must have been very frustrating for both of them in those therapy sessions. And so because we start with that, the lenses and that critical thinking like framework, and it's just repeated over and over, kids that struggled with language, I mean, that had language goals started to be able to complete narratives. Their vocabulary was improving, their sequencing, their, you know, ordering things in a temporal, you know, logical way was improving. And that, you know, like, yeah, the ramifications for that, how much more beneficial, how much more they got out of those counseling sessions. Like, yeah there's lots of uses. So,
and you know, you can only go from, you have to pick an area. And I think picking high school and middle school is a great area because those students are going to graduate or leave school at 21, 22. And they're laying the stage for everybody that comes behind them. Right. So for future generations, you're creating a safer space. You know, not that I want to neglect all the people that have gone before, but you've got to start somewhere. And I think starting at middle school and high school is perfect because it creates that runway that they're going to need. And with this increasing awareness, and I don't know how sincere it is yet or not, with DEI, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, and the conversation that we're having around disability, you know, awareness and acceptance, my hope is that as we get further along there in jobs and employment and employers start seeing this, maybe an employer says, hey, you know, we're seeing what the high schools are doing. Let's do an exercise with social optics, you know, within our own company and see what we can do there. And maybe we can get better communication between departments or, you know, things like, or maybe better management style, better management outcomes, right?
Or acceptance of, so I'm glad you brought that up too. You know, our company, I mean, we're small right now, but like 50% of our staff is also autistic. Like that's an important piece to me. You have to build with, you know, the community. Otherwise, how do you have their perspective? You know, there's a lot of talk about co-design and stuff. And to me, co-design is not, you know, or collaboration. And to me, those words are hollow when it's just simply a, you know, sitting next to somebody and, hey, what do you think about this color? What do you think about this lesson? Like, unless they build it and you're also paying them to build it with you.
Yes, that paying them is key.
Yeah, you know, and that's an interesting, you know, one of the folks who writes for us, he's very sweet. And he said, recruited him. I really stalked him on Facebook for quite a while because I loved his writing. But what I loved the way he wrote, I loved his perspectives, and he is autistic. And what I loved too about him was that I knew he was going through some rough stuff, but he always ended his essays with the positive, giving somebody else the benefit of the doubt. So when we had the opportunity and I hired him, but you know, he has a different work schedule. He likes to work on the weekends because this gives him structure on the weekends. He does other activities during the week because he has more of a, you know, routine, grocery shopping, things like that. He can keep the routine. He doesn't have to break it. I don't have a hard set schedule for him, you know, and right now, you know, he's on contract. So this income is supplementing, you know, some subsidized income that he has. And what I have watched, his anniversary date was last month. Oh no, it was actually last week with us for a whole year. And I've watched the evolution from somebody who was pretty stressed out all the time to he's now had employment for a year. It's consistent. He knows what to expect. He's not as worried about food shortage anymore. He is now able to find a counselor that he can work with. Like, and sometimes when I look at these neurodiverse movements in larger workplaces, and I want to kind of scream and say, unless you can figure out how you're going to hire and maintain someone who's homeless, then you're not actually doing it, because there are brilliant individuals who struggle with all of these other pieces who, if you could just give them a steady income for a year and you could let go of some of your preconceived notions of what this work needs to look like in a year, you would have your ideal employee.
Very well said, Carolyn. Very well said.
So I believe in walking the talk, and this, it wouldn't feel good to be successful if everyone wasn't becoming successful alongside. So it's been fun. I think too, one more thing like that with the communication piece, you know, individuals who experience severe trauma, especially, you know, autistic individuals who've been abused and how they internalize it. Like sometimes when there is a misunderstanding or a disagreement, that comes out as very large behaviors. So right in school districts, we see it as the chair throwing, the screaming, the whatever. It can be very scary. Some of those things don't go away because they're not fully able to engage in therapy. And so now you've got a 20-year-old with those same behaviors. And if you don't have a job, like a management system or a job system that's able to see that as just a piece of that individual that is going to work itself out when they feel safe, like it's like that's the end of the road for so many folks. And it really shouldn't be. It's just their, you know.
Yeah, I saw an article earlier today about resource. I don't remember what state it is. I published on LinkedIn, and you know, there's a state where they want resource officers to use physical, like mental restraints on people having behaviors in schools. And I would much rather see the money be spent on understanding what's causing those behaviors and how to eliminate those behaviors, instead of buying handcuffs or zip ties so you can restrain somebody. It really bothers me.
It is so mentally damaging to that individual. And the younger you start doing that stuff to a student at, it's like just multiply it times a million, how embedded it gets in that's the psyche and the core of that kiddo.
Yeah, I mean, Kentucky failed to pass a bill eliminating corporal punishment in schools. So corporal punishment is still, you can still have corporal punishment in Kentucky and I think 13 other states or 12 other states. And again, if we would use something like social optics to start working with these students and figuring out what's causing the behaviors and maybe helping them, give them the tools to communicate so they don't have to lash out in a physical manifestation of their frustration, I think we'd see better results.
And even overlaying this over a lot of the tools that are out there, you know, because there's so many strategies that I know schools use when kids, you know, get elevated to try to get them into a space where they can access their words and start to explain what happened. But even when you're doing that, if you don't have a really complete like craftsman toolkit of tools to start to tease out in a sequential way that is the same over time, it's not, you know, how Mrs. Harris asks, you know, Billy, what happened on the playground versus, you know, the principal, Mr. Sullivan, asking. And so then they get two different stories just because of the way they ask differently. It's the same, you know, toolkit. And it's a pretty detailed toolkit that lets a kid dive into, like, this is the area that's my weak area. So we're going to spend a lot of time on just getting the vocabulary, the things you saw, the things you heard, that kind of stuff. Then we're going to, you know, build it. Or some kids that are super good at getting that out, but then they're not good at the multiple perspectives piece of coming up with another. So it's that piece that I think can take anything a district is already using and just make it even better. Because, you know, it's that's the layer piece. I think that helps.
No, that's awesome. This has been a great conversation. Is there anything I should have asked that I didn't? Is there anything you want to make sure we cover? I'm going to include a link to the podcast, the other podcast you did. I'm going to include a link to your website, your email address. All of that's going to be in the show notes. But is there anything else I should have asked or anything else you want to bring up?
You know, I can't really think. I think we've covered a lot of stuff here. You know, I just want all the parents out there that are listening to this and all of, like, you know, and the teachers and the administrators, you know, and anyone who, like, who might also be autistic listening to your podcast. Like, we're all important and we all matter and everyone really does care about each other. It's just finding out the way to express that in a way that everyone can understand. You know, I don't know a single person who got into education to hurt a kiddo. You know, when we know better, we do better. And so, you know, if there's anybody I can share more information with, if there's, you know, something, like, no request is too small, no one is unimportant, so.
I think that's a perfect place to end it. No request is too small, no one is unimportant. Thank you, Carolyn. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this interview with Carolyn Long. As always, if you have ideas or guests that you would like me to interview, please email me, eric@specialneedsnavigator.us. I'm always open to talking to anybody that's doing amazing things for the disability community. I'm not worried about what type of disability. I'm disability agnostic. I just really want to improve the lives of those with disabilities and improve access to the tools and resources that people need to live the most independent lives possible. Again, thanks for listening. Till the next time.